Although the situation is by and large pessimistic, one of the things that I think does give me some optimism about this is that it doesn't have to be this way, and our brothers and sisters in a number of other countries have proven that. It may surprise you to hear this, or may not surprise you, depending on where you're coming from, but there are emerging global norms of privacy law, including the law for the privacy of data about what happens in the workplace, that have been adopted in Canada, in the European Union, and an increasing number of other countries around the world. The U.S., it's one of a number of areas, and this certainly won't surprise you, it's one of a number of areas where the U.S. has lagged behind the emergence of human rights law is privacy law. But if one of the ways to push for this is to start urging Congress to bring U.S. privacy law into line with the privacy laws of our trading partners. And there's actually beginning to be some pressure on American companies in a number of sectors, particularly travel, which is what I'm going to be talking about, because of the fact that their operations impact both countries, and they sort of have to, if they're going to comply with the law, improve their practices in the U.S. because it's required by the laws of other countries. So if we can get to some of the places that some other countries have, it is possible. Anyway, I write travel books. I'm a travel journalist. The series is The Practical Nomad, practicalnomad.com, and most of what I'm going to be talking about today has been stuff that I've been writing to some degree about in my books, but more recently in my blog. For those of you who are familiar with blogs, there's a link to it from practicalnomad.com. It's also on hasbrook.org if you can spell my name, but it's easier to spell Practical Nomad. So, anyway, even beginning a number of years ago, I've been talking about privacy as a key issue for travelers and travel consumers, and the significance of travel records from a privacy perspective, because they have names on them. They reveal a great deal about you, everywhere you've been, aspects of how you behave when you get there, what kinds of activities you engage in, and have an increasing potential for abuse. Unfortunately, what's happened since September 11th, 2001 has been that the hysteria around a perceived crisis of airline security, even though even in 2001 drunk drivers killed more than 10 times as many people in this country, 10 times as many travelers on the roads as airline terrorists did, and we don't seem to be saying, well, we need to abandon all pretense of civil liberties and start rounding up all the drunks off the road. But anyway, the perceived crisis of airline security has led to a willingness on part of government, at least, in the area of travel, to really sell out even what little protection of civil liberties we have. And that's put travel information very much in the crosshairs of the surveillance state. I've been writing about it mostly in the consumer context, but I've become increasingly concerned recently about the way that these homeland security measures are putting travel and transportation workers on the cutting edge of surveillance and monitoring of the actions of workers. And I'd like to talk about two initiatives of the government that are really at critical phases right now. You may or may not have heard of either of these, and I think the impact on workers' privacy of neither of them has really been explored, both of which are using travel workers as the guinea pigs for programs that will eventually impact larger categories of workers and people outside of the workplace, and travelers as well as workers in the travel industry. These are the CAPS-2 program, the Computer-Assisted Passenger Pre-Screening program of the Transportation Security Administration, and the Transportation Worker Identification Credential, TWIC. All these wonderful acronyms, the government loves acronyms. Which is also a project of the TSA. CAPS-2 has mostly been talked about. How many of you have heard of CAPS-2? Anybody? A few? Some? Okay. CAPS-2 has mostly been talked about as a profiling system. What you most likely have heard about is how the government is going to score each would-be airline passenger as green, yellow, or red on the basis of things like their Axiom record with all its inaccuracies. As to whether you will be allowed to travel, whether you will be given the third degree and then allowed to travel, or whether you'll not be allowed to travel at all, those being the meanings of green, yellow, and red. But beyond that, one of the ways that CAPS 2 would accomplish, CAPS 2, one of the other things that it will do is it will lead to, well, the way that it will accomplish that is through transferring all of the reservation records that the airlines currently have to the government so that it can conduct this profiling exercise. And it will also require the airlines and passengers to provide additional information designed to facilitate the construction out of individual reservations of what the government itself describes as a lifetime biographic travel history. A complete dossier of everywhere you've ever been on an airplane, who you went with, when, where, what you did there, what hotel you stayed in, and behind the closed doors of your hotel room, whether you asked for one bed or two with that person you were traveling with, which can be scrutinized an indefinite period of time in the future by anybody who feels like. And although you'll be providing this information under government order, it will now belong to and be owned by and be freely saleable by the airline or the reservation system of the travel agency. But there's been a lot of debate about that, and that's bad enough. But one of the sort of side effects of this is that it will also involve the government having histories of the activities of those who enter these travel reservations, which is mainly people in airline call centers and reservation centers, airline counter reservation and check-in agents, and travel agents. When reservations are made, each time anything is added, you make a reservation, you add a flight, you add a hotel, you reserve a seat, you check in a bag, that is entered in an audit trail that records the terminal address of the travel agent or airline staff person who entered it, their unique identifier, the time that that was entered, and exactly what that entry was. So collectively, airline reservations contain not exactly a keystroke level record, but an entry level. Every line command, basically, unless it's deleted, every line command that's permanently stored in a reservation has with it in the audit trail the personal identification of the individual travel reservation worker who entered it. And so out of the data that the government will acquire under CAPS 2, either the government or the airlines or the reservation committees, companies, any of them that wanted to, will have the capability to construct a complete profile for someone in a call center of all the different reservations they've made for different people, or for a travel agent figuring out, okay, this person is suspicious and came for this travel agent. Let's see all the other people this travel agent made reservations for around the same time. I mean, one of the things about travel data that makes it so invasive is it enables the government to build maps of the relationships between people, which surveillance people love. Now, there are a couple of interesting things about this aspect of CAPS, too. The first is that the government has never disclosed it. There have been many criticisms. Privacy activism and myself and many, many other groups filed comments. There have been two rounds of Privacy Act notices on the CAPS 2 program, both of which prompted more public comments than any other Privacy Act notice in the government's history. Neither of those Privacy Act notices ever mentioned this. In fact, they specifically said that and falsely said that the only people on whom travel reservations would contain personally identifiable information would be the passengers themselves, never mentioning the workers who enter this with their sign-in codes attached to it and permanently stored in the audit trail of every reservation. In fact, this is one of the things that I think provides the clearest basis for blocking CAPS 2 if they try to put it into place, is that they've never given the proper notice to these people. And again, I've begun to hear some, although not so much from the U.S. where this hasn't been as much awareness, but where this has been even more controversial in Europe, some of the opposition is beginning to bubble up from workers for reservation companies and airlines who are beginning to become aware of this. And a lot of the use of the Privacy Act historically has been by workers whose information was included in records that they created about other people. So there's clearly a whole angle of this that the government has evaded and refused to acknowledge and has yet to enter into a discussion with those several hundred thousand travel agents and airline reservation workers. The second thing is that it appears that this is like purely incidental. I don't think they even realized that they were doing this. They're concerned so little for the privacy of workers that they didn't even care and they didn't even know it. Unfortunately, the flip side of that is that they have not yet you know, they're far from maxing out the potential for exploiting this. I think the only reason that they haven't done more to abuse this is that they haven't realized the power they had. And, you know, once they start to get these kinds of logs, then third-party companies are likely to come along and start offering log analyzer software to put this stuff together, and it all spirals. You know, you really have to block this stuff in the early stages before it goes out there. So if there are any of you working in any of those fields, call centers, travel agencies, reservation centers, airline gate and counter staff, this is a key issue of a whole category of very detailed mapping of people's on-the-job activities that the government is going to require under CAPS too. The other program I want to talk to you about is the Transportation Worker Identification Credential. And this one is probably even worse, actually. I think CAPS 2 is worse in terms of what it would do for consumers, but the Transportation Worker Identification Credential is really evil. This is a project that began, again, in the panic after September 11th. The idea was, you know, bar the doors, bar the borders, and you've heard some of the other stuff that's been going on, fingerprinting and photographing foreign visitors and so forth and so on. There became great concern about how people, whether bad guys, assuming that we know who the bad guys are, which we don't, but that's a whole other story, whether bad guys might be able to not just get on planes, but be able to get into a port or get into some other transportation facility. And again, with apparently no regard whatsoever for privacy or for workers' rights, a whole program began bringing together a broad range of government agencies. This was before even the creation of the Department of Homeland Security or the Transportation Security Administration, a broad range of government agencies, most of which are now in the TSA and the DHS, a whole bunch of corporations and businesses involved in the transportation industry, from maritime operators, port operators, airports, airlines, hazardous materials, trucking companies, you name it. And the government agencies and the private industry with these, as well as all the police type agencies. And the technology providers, and of course there was a whole rush to get on the Homeland Security gravy train, so there's now, you know, a multi-billion dollar industry of people who, you know, whose future profitability of their companies depends on keeping us scared and paying billions of dollars a year to fend off those nebulous mystery enemies somewhere, you know. If we don't have an enemy, well then what are we fighting this war about? So, out of that, and one of the really interesting things that I found was an early document from that process going back to January of 2002, quite early, in which the action group on the transportation worker ID card said that the focus of the solution was on workers in the transportation system while achieving sufficient flexibility to accommodate future needs to address identification of users of the transportation system, i.e. it was explicitly designed from the start with the idea that it would be guinea pigged on workers, somehow your rights in the workplace being more expendable, or at least that they thought politically it would be easier to put it over as something for people in workplace environment, but with a plan from the start, more than 2 years ago, that it would eventually be applied to users of the transportation system, i.e. travelers. Interestingly enough, although that was disclosed publicly in early 2002, that's completely disappeared and hasn't been mentioned since, although it's still clearly the agenda behind this that eventually it will be rolled out to travelers. So what does this credential consist of? The idea is to have a unified ID card that would be a common ID that would verify that you were an authorized person who'd gone through the kind of background check involving your criminal record, your Axiom record, all that kind of stuff full of misinformation and disinformation, that would prove that you were an authorized person and not a would-be terrorist if you were seeking to enter any transportation facility. Now, it's very broadly defined, transportation facilities including ports, airports, again, trucks carrying hazardous materials which come under federal regulation, train stations, you name it. The idea was to have a common credential, and it was specifically also, I think, one of its other sort of evil aspects, is that it was designed as a public, private partnership, i.e., although this would be a government-mandated card, it was designed to facilitate its use by employers for whatever uses they might wish to make of it from the start, as opposed to a government-mandated card whose use was limited to the government purposes for which it was devised. And that has some very, very bad implications in the way the design turned out. Over the course of 2002 and 2003, the program was developed, and a number of different models were tested out. The basic thing behind all of them was that this would be an ID card that would somehow prove who you were, and thus that it would have, that it would be machine-readable and would have stored on it in some machine-readable form something that identified you. And they tested out in the prototype tests in 2003, which were mainly done at port facilities in New Jersey and Delaware and Pennsylvania, one, and two at a number of ports in Southern California, mainly around L.A. and Long Beach. There were also some airport tests at both Philadelphia and LAX. It's bringing one of my surprises on you. One of the locations for the prototype tests of these cards was actually an ILWU union hall. And I have no idea whether the union officers were aware or why they allowed this to be tested out. But if you can imagine, deliberately allowing the government to set up a tracking mechanism to log the name and time and identity of every person who comes in and out of the union hall. So it's not just access to the overall facility, but tracking where people go within it. Anyway, the idea was that this would have stored in some secure digital form, machine-readable, something that uniquely identifies you, a biometric, something about your body. And they explored a number of different technologies for storing this, whether in a mag stripe, like on a credit card, or in a 2D barcode, which you may never have seen, but it's kind of like the linear barcode, only it's a box that can store a lot more data that you can actually put a digital photo in. I've seen prototypes of these. Or in an RFID, radio frequency ID chip, a radio chip, and I'll come back to that in a minute. They also looked at several different biometric identifiers, a digital photograph, which is probably the easiest, but on the other hand, they figure people, it's easier to disguise yourself than your face than to disguise your fingerprints. They also looked at fingerprints, and they looked at iris scans, the pattern of blood vessels in your eyes is unique for each individual. And they looked at hand geometry, the shape of your hand, which is already used in some commercial access control systems. They looked at all of these across a range of things and eventually decided, after this process, earlier this year, decided and settled on the use of a photograph and fingerprint as the biometrics to be stored on each card, centrally issued by the government, but again, in an open standard so that any corporation that wanted to use this for any purpose would be able to make use of it, and that the technology for storing this biometric on the card would be an RFID chip. How many of you know what RFID is, or how many have heard of RFID? Okay, a couple people. This is the badge that I wear. These have been, you know, RFID is sort of the next thing in Big Brother, and you're going to be hearing a lot more about it. The concern about it, RFID chips are remotely readable radio chips, and the basic way they work, this is the badge I wear to get into the office building where I work. And these sort of started, you know, this kind of high security stuff, it started with government buildings, military facilities. Then it spread after September 11th to office, you know, high-rise office buildings. Now it's being rolled out to transportation workers. And eventually there are proposals under active consideration right now to mandate the inclusion of these in all kinds of other identity documents, from passports to boarding passes for travelers. Fortunately, at the moment, my badge, this is this is a step behind what they're doing with TWIC. I have a badge with my photograph on it. The biometric, if I can get it out of, well, it's like your standard photo badge. Then I have a separate card that has the chip in it. In the TWIC, these will be merged together so that the thing with the photograph on it will have the chip in it, which will mean you can't show the photo card or have it displayed without having it available to anybody who wants to read it with a radio card. And what this has in it, you can't really tell that this has a chip in it. The cards can actually be much larger, much smaller than this and have a chip in them. And What this is, it's a passive device. It's a little integrated circuit. It doesn't have a battery in it. But basically, you have a little box that's the reader, and you can put these wherever you want. They cost a couple $100. These things cost maybe 50 cents, and the price is dropping as the volume goes up. And the box constantly sends out radio pulses saying, Any chips out there? Any chips out there? Any chips out there? It just keeps pulsing. And this thing, whenever it gets a pulse on the right frequency, it stores a little of that energy, and it uses that energy to send back an answer saying, yes, I'm here, and I'm number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 32K bits of other information, which is actually quite a lot, and can store almost all sorts of things. The evil of this, as it compared to somebody saying, show me your badge, is you don't know whether they've read this. I have no idea right now whether anybody has read this. And in fact, at the place where I work, the maintenance of this as an access control system at the front door is outsourced to some third-party company. My employer themselves hasn't even been able to tell me, although they'd like to, but they don't even know who keeps the logs of access to the front gate or what they do with them. And that's pretty common. But at least in my present situation, it's separate, and I can wear my badge around. And I only need this in the front door, and I can stick it in a tinfoil envelope once I get into the office, so you know they can't track me around. Once it's merged with the badge, and once you have to have the badge while you're on the facility, which is the whole point of the TWIC card as a transportation worker credential, as long as they mandate that you have it displayed at all times, they have mandated that you make it available to anybody, your employer, anybody else, who wants to invest a couple $100 in this public specification reader to keep a log of whoever comes within. I can tell, because by the way, at my office, because it works the lock on the front door, it clicks at about 5 to 6 feet. And that's kind of typical. There's several different frequencies and ranges, but that's a kind of typical range in actual use, is 5 or 6 feet. Which means if you have to walk through a doorway, there's no way you can tell whether there's a reader in the doorway that's logging the unique identifier number of each one of these things that goes through. And it's not just like a product code. In consumer use, they're trying to liken these to a barcode, but the barcode only identifies the category of product. These are unique numbers. I mean, Gillette is actually trying these out with razor blades, where each individual box of razor blades on the shelf has its own number. So they can track an individual item. In conjunction with industry, they developed something like called the Government Smart Card Interoperability Standard, so that all the different chips that are going to be put in these TWIC cards, that in the future we'll put in passports, probably in driver's license, will all be readable by the same readers with the same standards to anybody who can get within 6 feet of you when you're forced to display it. One can imagine a whole range of abuses that could be made of these. I think initially the impetus for this was simply for access control. I mean, my bosses haven't ever really thought about being able to keep a log of everybody who goes near the water cooler. It's just they moved into an office building and this was the installation, the access control mechanism, and they could either pay the subscription to sign everybody up in this. Oh, and by the way, to get into the door once you get off the elevator, I have to put my finger on a fingerprint scanner, which is the same ones that they're using now at the borders for all visitors to the U.S., except from Canada, and certain ones from Mexico. But it was easier just to pay the subscription fee to this third-party outsourced company that does God knows what with the logs of who comes and goes than it was to pay to install locks on the doors. You know, and all they were interested in is, well, we need to have locks on the doors. Similarly, I think the initial impetus for this was indeed genuinely the desire, misguided though it was, to respond to the perceived overwhelming threat of terrorism. But once it's there, I don't think it's going to be very much time at all before companies start realizing, hey, wait a minute, we've got, the government has forced everybody on this port, once they go through the front gate, to be displaying at all times a radio tracking device. And if we want to know who's congregating by the water cooler, all we need to do is put a reader there and we can get a log of who was at the water cooler at the same time and how long they spent there. How long did they spend in the bathroom? How long did they spend in the break room? Who hangs out with whom and where? All of this kind of stuff. So although that probably isn't even the intent, once this infrastructure is in place, it's going to be very difficult to constrain the uses for this. And interestingly enough, the Privacy Act notice for the TWIC program has virtually no restriction. Well, it has no restriction whatsoever on the ability of a company to put its own separate reader and read the same data and do whatever they want with it. And even the data the government uses can be disclosed to in response to any federal, state, local, tribal, territorial, foreign, or international agency. I mean, I find particularly disturbing the idea that they can give it to anybody at all if they're not in the U.S. In response to queries regarding persons who may pose a risk to transportation. Not who are likely to, but who may. Well, anybody might. That's no standard at all. That says you can give it to anybody you want. How long are they going to keep these logs of who comes and goes from the ports? As of yet, they haven't said anything at all. There's no requirement. There's no disclosure yet in the Privacy Act notice about how long they will keep these or whether they will be whether will be destroyed. This is a very large-scale program. What's happened just this month is they've signed a memorandum of understanding between the TSA and the state of Florida to expand greatly the next phase. Now that they've picked the most privacy-invasive technology, the RFID chip, as the basis for the next round of prototyping, they're ramping this up from a few tens of thousands of people in the earlier tests to some hundreds of thousands across the same range of port and airport facilities in the mid-Atlantic states and in Southern California. They're also adding, though, to the next phase, a much larger number of people at all of the seaports in Florida, where there's been intense concern because of the dependence of Florida tourism on cruise business. And they really want to reassure the people who are coming to go take a cruise from Florida that they'll be adequately protected. As a result, the Florida legislature has enacted laws to sell out the privacy of their own Floridians who work at the ports in order to pander to the unwarranted fears of foreign tourists. Isn't that delightful? Anyway, Florida state legislature mandated that this technology be adopted, that all Florida ports use this federally developed standard. So that'll be the next round of the rollout starting this month in Florida. By sometime next year, they plan to be rolling it out across the, assuming all goes well with those next rounds of tests, they plan to be rolling out across all transportation workers. Over a million aviation workers at airports mainly and some air cargo facilities off airport. Another million workers in maritime facilities at ports. 4 million people in hazardous materials transportation, mainly in the Teamsters, truckers. 5.8 million in other transportation facilities ranging from highway toll takers and workers to mass transit, pipelines, you name it. A total of, the government estimates in the initial rounds, something like 12 million people who will be mandated throughout their working hours to wear remotely, secretly readable to anybody who wants to read them, radio tracking tags, of which there's no restriction whatsoever on how the data from those can be used. And if you're not scared yet, you ought to be. So that's some of what's coming down the pike. You know, I think there's been a sense that somehow, you know, people in the workplace aren't people in the workplace. They're workers. They're not us. We're not workers our way. We're consumers, I think, you know, or whatever we are. We're not workers. So somehow things which infringe on our privacy in the workplace aren't publicly perceived as things which infringe on our privacy. They're things that might restrict people in the workplace, but that's restricting workers, some other people. You're still free as a consumer to do whatever you want, never mind the fact that we spend most of our waking hours, most of us, in our workplace. And that in reality, the standards of privacy and rights that we have on the workplace are the default, really, for most of our lives. So, you know, there's also been, I think, you know, an acquiescence after September 11th that somehow the Homeland Security juggernaut was unstoppable. That the level, you know, it took a while for people to recognize that the claims were being made were exaggerated. There was a really evil coincidence of interests where both corporations wanting to control and monitor their employees and government surveillance entities had an interest in promoting fear and hysteria so as to use that as the method to get people to accept the construction of an infrastructure of tracking, whether it's through the RFID cards or whether it's through CAPS 2 and the related proposals, which basically are transforming the existing commercial airline reservation system into a system restructured to meet the needs of, and desires of government to have it function also as a surveillance system. So those interests of governments and surveillance interests of corporations and surveillance interests in the governments have coincided with the opportunity presented by the panic after September 11th to
to push the legislation behind this stuff very far downfield before people began to wake up to the dangers. So on the one hand, I think this stuff is really scary. I think there are really strong reasons for it to be resisted. I think if we can force the government to come out and engage in a more open debate about this stuff, it would not withstand public debate. And I've certainly seen that happening already with CAPS II, which has been set back repeatedly, even though the government really, a year ago, the government thought it was going to be a cakewalk. They actually did not anticipate opposition on CAPS II. Really misjudged the public. The more people know, the more they oppose this. I hope the same thing will happen on the transit worker identification credential. But I also say that, you know, people have to really wake up quickly and start moving very quickly, because there is enormous momentum that's accumulated since September 11th behind these proposals. So on the one hand, you know, transportation workers, people in the workplace, are on the cutting edge of our rights, but on, you know, from the bad side, you know, we're the first to lose them. And those are the places where we're first to lose them. But on the good side, it's an opportunity to stand on the front lines of the struggle against the surveillance state. So that's some of what's happening. And we've got, well, I'm not sure how far behind time we're running, but we've got at least some time for questions about any or all of this.